Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first part of the program today, we'll be looking back on the life of one of the more complex figures of the last century, someone certainly who is a very important figure in the history of his country. And the man we're talking about here is Japan's last emperor, Hirohito. He was emperor of Japan from 1926 until his death in 1989. He was the longest reigning monarch in Japan's history. And probably people today, if they have many people, if they have memories of Hirohito, they will think of a rather shy and grandfatherly man, someone who seems not particularly interested to be in the public eye, someone who would have said that he wasn't interested in participating in politics, not then and really not ever, someone who, if he had his way, would like to essentially be left alone to pursue his great passion, which was marine biology. However, now many scholars are giving us another picture of Hirohito based on information that fairly recently has become available about Hirohito's involvement in Japanese policy before and during World War II. And this morning we'll be talking with one of those scholars. His name is Herbert Bix. He says that from the very beginning, Hirohito was a dynamic emperor, but paradoxically also one who projected the defensive image of a passive monarch. However, in his book, Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan, he argues indeed that Hirohito was not a passive monarch. He writes in the introduction to the book that it challenges the orthodoxy established long before the Asia-Pacific War and fostered afterward by the leaders of the Allied occupation, that Hirohito was merely a figurehead within a framework of autocratic imperial rule and a puppet of the military. It also challenges the idea the army was mainly responsible for Japan's aggression in the 30s and 40s, pointing out the long-neglected role of the Navy in all of this. It further argues a number of things, including the fact that Hirohito himself said that he was committed to an international peace code that criminalized aggressive war but pursued a policy toward China that violated the spirit of Japan's voluntarily assumed treaty obligations embodying that code. And we'll talk more this morning about Japan during this time and about Hirohito's role in its history with our guest Herbert Bix. He is the author of this recently published book, Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. It's published by HarperCollins. It was this year's Pulitzer Prize winner for general nonfiction and has gotten a lot of favorable comments. Our guest has been writing about Japan for something like 30 years, writing about modern and contemporary Japanese history. He has taught at many universities in Japan and here in the United States. Currently, he's at State University of New York, Binghamton, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Herbert Bix, you're certainly welcome to give us a call if you have questions, comments. All we need ask for of people is that people just are brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. But certainly comments, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Bix, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you
for having me on your show.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We're really pleased that we could have the opportunity. There are many things I think we could talk about, but I suppose that perhaps just here at the front, we should emphasize what seems in many ways to be the headline of the book, and that is, as you write in the introduction, that you and I think other scholars are now bringing us a very different view of Hirohito that does indeed call into question the image that we got that was created in part by him and others in the elite of Japan and also by the occupation, that he essentially was a hostage of the military before and during the war and that he had no direct role in Japan's activities in China, in the rest of East Asia, in its attack on the United States and in war policy generally.
Yes, that's true. That's the primary myth. Hirohito as an impotent, politically impotent figurehead who bore no responsibility for Japan's expansion of its conflict in China in the 1930s, and a man who was a pacifist and had merely acceded to but never backed the decision that followed the start of the 4 years after the start of the China War, the decision to initiate war with the United States and Britain. So I address those myths, and I also argue that, yes, he was not a passive constitutional monarch, because Japan itself, Imperial Japan, never had a constitutional monarchy. Further, I say that Hirohito wasn't the heroic loser who in August 1945 had single-handedly stopped the fighting rather than see his people suffer longer. On the contrary, he helped delay surrender. So my biography presented a very complex, stubborn, conflicted, and I always say tense and nervous man with a passion for detail and order that often blinded him to the big picture. And the first part of the book is devoted to his education, to explaining how he became the sort of person he was. And then I have a section, a number of chapters, which look into his efforts to be a benevolent monarch, because being a benevolent monarch was to live up to the traditional Japanese image of a monarch. And this traditional image went back many, many centuries and was understood in the West from the moment the Jesuits began writing about Japan and described a country where power and authority were long separated, with authority vested in a ceremonial monarch, religious figure, sequestered in the capital in Kyoto, and then a military leader having a headquarters elsewhere in the country. And so this long-standing notion that Japan was a country where power and authority were separated served to underpin the image of the modern monarchs from Hirohito's grandfather Meiji onward as being figureheads. So I would say that Hirohito was able to capitalize on this deeply entrenched stereotype.
Let me ask, if I may, a question about you're jumping ahead from that point to ask a question about American policy during the occupation. One can certainly understand from Hirohito's point of view that that the idea that he was a passive monarch and was not directly involved in policy making during the war, he would be interested in promoting that viewpoint because it would perhaps prevent his being tried as a war criminal. Why was it that the United States was also interested in promoting that image of the emperor?
Well, promoting that image of the emperor, when you say the United States, we're talking about General MacArthur and the top members of the Truman administration who made policy toward Japan, because it was felt that using the emperor as a puppet would facilitate acceptance by the Japanese people of American occupation objectives. The reform objectives were initially to demilitarize and democratize Japan. Now, Japan's leaders, with Emperor Hirohito at the forefront, decided at the moment they capitulated to cooperate with the Allies and to seize the initiative and demilitarize themselves. MacArthur arrives in Japan, and the process of demilitarization is well underway, and MacArthur has a notion of using the emperor for his next task, which was democratization of the authoritarian Japanese state. So I would say that it was mutual convenience and it was, that led to this de facto alliance arrangement between, a de facto partnership might be more accurate, between the American government, General MacArthur on the one hand, and the Japanese government and Hirohito on the other.
And General MacArthur and the other people that were responsible for making this policy and remaking Japan after the war, they were well aware of the role that Hirohito had played?
No, one can't say that they were well aware of it. It's not clear to what extent they were aware of the deep involvement of Hirohito in every stage of planning the Pearl Harbor attack, but they certainly regarded him as culpable, as the head of state, and as culpable, and they wanted to protect him and especially ensure him, shield him from the Tokyo War Crimes trials. So they did that. In effect, Hirohito, the first Axis leader to fall into Allied hands, was given a type of political pardon. And this came about because policymakers in Washington procrastinated on policy toward the emperor. They initially decided and instructed MacArthur, General MacArthur, to collect the evidence, and then a decision would be made, but MacArthur was not to act on his own. Well, MacArthur never really investigated. There's no evidence that MacArthur investigated the emperor's role in policy making. And what he did do was, from the outset, shield the emperor. And then, because American people in general believe too much, too uncritically, in MacArthur's words. He was the great war hero, after all. When MacArthur sent his famous telegram to General Eisenhower in Washington in January of 1946, saying that if we indict the emperor, you'll have to send me 1 million troops, and it'll cost American taxpayers enormous money. We'll have to prolong the occupation. And this, immediately afterward, the Truman administration caved in. MacArthur got his wish, and Hirohito was granted immunity from punishment, from investigation. His papers were placed off limits to the members of the International Prosecution Section of the occupation, whose task it was, you know, to investigate likely indictees. And what happened was that Hirohito and those closest to him entered into a relationship with MacArthur's top officials and members of the international prosecution team, including Joseph Barry Keenan, the chief counsel, chief prosecutor at the war crimes trial, and they helped to select the Japanese indictees, the men who would stand trial. So Japan's leaders in August, when they capitulated and surrendered, had as their primary goal to protect the monarchy, with Hirohito occupying the throne, and MacArthur had the same goal. Hirohito was granted immunity, and so we never got to learn how the decision-making system actually worked, with him at the center as the supreme commander, and the official Japanese view of how the war ended became the official American view, and those who were victimized by the Japanese in all of the Asian Pacific countries that Imperial Japan had invaded, they did not have full justice done. In many cases, justice was not done. So the historical record ultimately was falsified and crimes weren't punished because impunity was granted to a head of state. And a precedent was thereby reestablished, an ancient precedent that the head of state, the top leaders, is immune from punishment, above the law. And this is something that Americans should reflect upon, because our leaders who drew the American people into the war against the peoples of Indochina, starting with Lyndon Baines Johnson and continuing with Richard Nixon and his national security chief, Henry Kissinger, they were never indicted for war crimes. So I think that this issue of impunity is very important and is deserving of careful reflection and study.
We have a couple of callers that would like to come into the conversation, and we certainly welcome that. Let me introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Herbert Bix. He has written extensively on modern and contemporary Japanese history. He's taught at universities in Japan and in the United States. His recent biography of Hirohito is titled Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. The book is published by HarperCollins. And the questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers. We'll start with someone in Chicago, and this is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah. I have two questions. I'll try to hurry so that I don't take up too much time. Is it true that in 1944, Japan tried to get in touch with America through Switzerland to end the war early, provided we could guarantee that the emperor would not be prosecuted as a war criminal?
Professor Bix?
Efforts were made. There were many non-official Japanese overtures to the Allies. I don't remember the exact dates of these numerous overtures, but some were through Switzerland, through Sweden, and these were not the official Japanese government efforts. The official Japanese government efforts, and the only ones that counted, were those peace feelers, so-called, that were put out via Moscow in Japan's effort to end the war.
Apparently Roosevelt's no-surrender policy did prolong it quite a bit, not only in Asia but in Europe as well.
Well, the unconditional surrender policy, any time a demand for unconditional surrender is made, to some extent it delays the surrender process, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that this was the result of Roosevelt's unconditional surrender policy.
I see. Well, the other question I wanted to ask was, how much did the emperor know about a unit called 731 in Manchuria?
Well, he signed the order to create it. Documentary evidence of, establishing his, knowledge of the activities of Unit 731 is scant, but he certainly issued the orders to set it up.
Well, this General Ishii was the Joseph Mengele of Southeast Asia. Unfortunately,
well, of Southeast Asia, why would you? The Unit 731 didn't operate in Southeast Asia.
Well, it operated in Manchuria, though. It operated in.
It operated in Manchuria. It operated in North China. And insofar as Japanese troops use gas in the various fronts in China, maybe a Unit 731 components were involved. But not in Southeast Asia, I believe.
Well, all right, let me amend it then and say that he would be the closest thing to that, because this unit did some terrible things. And apparently after the war was over...
Yes, not on the scale of Germany, I believe, not on the scale of Germany.
Well, I don't know.
The Germans sought, as I understand it, genocide was a national policy of the German nation under Hitler. I don't think the Japanese in China set out to exterminate
Well, I'm not gonna get into it. You'd know more about it than I would, but I know the Shuna did some terrible things, and some Americans were involved.
Indeed, yes.
But apparently, after the war, is it true that we made an agreement with this unit that we would none of the people would be tried if we got their medical records?
Yes, we did.
I don't think that's beyond debate now.
That's not beyond debate. MacArthur, General MacArthur, with approval of the War Department, made granted many immunities from prosecution. Not only the Unit 731. Offices, but Japan's poison gas warfare in China was not pursued, although it was supposed to be. It was in the, listed in the indictment, but the American Chemical Warfare Corps was opposed to it, and American military did not want to get poison gas sanctioned by an international war crimes trial because our military thought that we might use poison gas in a war against the Soviet Union. So the most cynical reasons prevailed soon after the Tokyo trials began, before and after, and before, during, and after the Tokyo trials. I agree with you on that.
We're getting very close already to the midpoint. I hope the caller will not mind if I go on and to our next person, which is Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Hi. That brings to mind the release of these new documents about the recruitment of Nazi into the spy, the Galen ring and all that on the Eastern and the European theater. But I wanted to get back to the caller's first point, the idea of unconditional surrender. I mean, it wasn't Roosevelt's idea. I mean, it was maybe initially his idea, but it was government policy through the end of the war. And it seems to me that rather than focusing on MacArthur's need to use the emperor in post-war Japan, that the reason it was good for the U.S. government, from their point of view, was that it allowed people to step back from this unconditional surrender. Then, in other words, if Hirohito wasn't entirely culpable, the idea that his stepping down was part of the unconditional surrender could be
part of Hirohito never stepped down. I don't understand the question. I wish to respond to you, but I don't
understand the question. Let me go on a little bit. Unconditional surrender included Hirohito no longer being emperor.
No longer being sovereign. That's quite true. Yes.
People that argue that the war was extended unnecessarily, which was pointed at by this first question, and the peace feelers argue that the war had to be extended so that the firebombing of Tokyo could go ahead and the bomb could be used to demonstrate it to the Soviets and the rest of the world. And after that happened, how do you explain why you would no longer insist on unconditional surrender? And the one way to do that, and it works in with the policy, is that, well, Hirohito wasn't that culpable, so we don't really need for him to stand down. Is that clear?
I'm not sure. Americans insisted on the principle of unconditional surrender. Once the Japanese government accepted the principle, then the terms that were cited in the Potsdam Declaration would begin to kick in. Because we insisted on unconditional surrender, MacArthur could become the supreme commander of the Allied powers and the virtual sovereign of Japan, and Hirohito could be subordinated to him. This put the American government in a position to affect its post-surrender objective of reforming and democratizing Japan. Japan's leaders weren't willing to democratize their country to the extent that the Japanese people wished. And having said that, the decision to keep Hirohito on the throne was another matter. The Japanese people and members of Hirohito's own family expected him to be sanctioned in some way for his role in the war. In fact, his brothers felt he'd done a poor job, and they expected, they didn't feel he had a proprietary right to hang on. But MacArthur insisted that he hang on. And so after a short period of vacillation, which comes very early, I think, August and early September, Hirohito insists on staying on the throne. So we keep the same man for whom the Japanese people fought in China and in the Pacific on the throne. We protected him, and this had, I think, very negative consequences for Japan and East Asia. I believe that Hirohito took advantage of this situation. American government leaders made a mistake, I believe. We could have had the same outcome, a Japan that was anti-communist, militarily subordinated to the United States, without Hirohito on the throne. There was this false notion around immediately after Hirohito, immediately after Japan surrendered, and this was the notion that if the American government moved to depose Hirohito, it would be equivalent to throwing a stone at a hornet's nest. But that wasn't the case, and those who made that argument were ignorant of the Japanese scene and the feelings of the Japanese people. There was a window of opportunity when the Japanese people were expecting and would have accepted abdication. Now, abdication is not the same, of course, as abolition of the monarchy. And I don't think it was ever an American objective to abolish the monarchy. There was a discussion in Washington of having the Japanese go on record in regard to their feelings toward the imperial institution. And, of course, the first post-surrender general election did serve to endorse the continuation of the monarchy, not necessarily continuation of Hirohito on the throne.
Of course, one of the political parties was barred, but I don't think our minds are going to meet on this because I don't think you've quite taken my point to refute it, and that is that you can say that the principle of unconditional surrender was accepted, but if one of the major conditions, either the abdication, getting
that wasn't
Hirohito in one way or another, was not part of it, obviously you've stepped away from one of the conditions. And I think
I don't understand
it was convenient for American policymakers after the war to not have to discuss Hirohito's culpability, because then they wouldn't have to defend the lack of that condition. And I'll hang up and listen to the rest. Thanks.
All right, let's go on to another caller. This is Muhammad. It's line two. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Yes.
During World War II, the Japanese weaponry was very offensively designed.
I miss that. The Japanese what?
Weaponry was very offensively designed. For example, their fighter plane, the Zero, had very little plating. Their cruisers and battleships had very little plating, yet they were loaded with guns. So when they were on the offensive, they were formidable, but when they were on the defensive, they didn't last very long. I'm wondering, does Hirohito have any influence on that mentality that they had in designing their weapons? I never thought of him as being involved in that, but you're suggesting he had more influence in their military strategies.
Well, the Zero fighter wasn't defensively armored, didn't have much protection for the pilot. Japanese tanks were very crude. Japanese artillery was quite inferior to American, British artillery.
But the Zero and the cruisers and battleships weren't inferior. They were just simply a different design philosophy.
Yes, yes.
I've always thought of that as, the traditional, conventional wisdom on that was that there was a kind of an ego involved, where the Japanese mentality was, we will never be on the defensive because we are the aggressor. they cast themselves into the aggressor role.
Well, they believed in the offensive. They didn't see themselves as aggressors. They saw themselves as liberators of East Asia from Anglo-American imperialism, but not as aggressors. It's true. They did believe in the cult of the offensive, and they clung dogmatically to it and neglected the defense until it was too late. Part of it was making a virtue out of necessity. After the Russo-Japanese War, which ends in 1905, Japan's military leaders have to think of rebuilding their armed forces, and Japan is a late developer, seeking to modernize on many fronts. And so spiritualism, a belief in the primacy of spirit and mind over matter, is emphasized in a way it had not been before the Russo-Japanese War. And I think that the neglect of weaponry, of artillery, and of and building ships that didn't have these adequate armor, I think that all of this is part of a an attitude toward war that develops in the period between the Russo-Japanese War and World War One, and the Japanese military in the 20s is forced, the Navy is forced to undertake tonnage reductions, and the Army cuts back, and I would say that this was a reflection of where Japan stood as a late developing nation. It had to make a virtue out of necessity. Of course, the emphasis on spirit drew on a cultural heritage that Americans weren't familiar with, drew on Buddhist precepts in particular. Yes.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here again, and I would like to introduce our guest. We're speaking with Herbert Bix. At the moment, he is teaching at State University of New York, Binghamton, although he has taught at universities in Japan and here in the United States. He's written a great deal on modern and contemporary Japanese history. His most recent book, if you would like to look at it, deals with the matter we're discussing this morning. The title is Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. It is a biography of Japan's last emperor, Hirohito, who reigned from 1926 until his death in 1989. The book is published by HarperCollins and won this year's Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. And questions are welcome, and we have quite a few of them. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And again, I'll have to ask the callers to try to be brief just so we can accommodate as many people as possible here. We'll go next to Champagne and Line 1. Hello?
Hello. One of the reviews of your very interesting book pointed out that actually since your book came out, there's a memo that surfaced from, of all people, Edwin Reischauer, written in 1942, in which he says it would be a very good idea to retain the emperor as a puppet after the war in order to keep down domestic radicalism and so forth.
Yes, I read that memo.
Quite an amazing. Well, I mean, you know, the fact that that was being talked about it, I would have thought relatively junior levels of the American government already after after the Battle of Midway. I mean, that's quite remarkable.
It's remarkable. He was a lecturer at Harvard at the time he wrote it.
And in later years, a sort of Kennedy liberal, huh?
Yeah, eventually rising to become ambassador to Japan in the Kennedy period.
But doesn't this suggest that the American government had sort of plans of the sort that, I mean, it wasn't sort of just MacArthur falling into it at the end. This was what the U.S. was planning from early on.
I agree with you. What I say in the book that MacArthur's attitude toward the emperor, his policy, rather, reflected the common sense of American psychological warfare experts in the Pacific from about 1943 onward. And of course, I could have added, it reflected the emerging common sense of the American anthropological establishment.
Ruth Benedict and whatnot.
Yeah.
John Dower apparently has found something too, in which Hirohito himself says a memo of his from 46 saying, "I hope the occupation will last a long time." I mean,
yes, I have similar documents.
Astonishing.
On that. He wants it to last a long time, and he likens it to an earlier period of reform, the Taika reforms. Japan's leaders thought long and hard about surrender, thought long and hard about surrender. They thought long and hard about the best way to lose the war. And having lost the war, and they decided to cling to the United States and cooperate with the United States as much as possible so that they might rebuild the country and take advantage of everything that America might offer Japan. The Cold War was, of course, a great boon here, and it helped Japan's conservative leaders in many ways. It also helped them to put a seal on the study of the war years. It sealed it that the Americans then pressed harder, inadvertently, mind you. But the teaching of Japanese history of the war years gets interdicted just as the Japanese struggle to come to terms with their past gets interdicted by this complex relationship with the United States. And I think that's deserving of more study.
It seems like this conjunction of interest between American planners and the emperor, though, was based on their joint desire to suppress domestic radicalism, that this was a way to keep the lid on, so to speak.
Indeed it was. And it's a cooperative relationship, it's a partnership, and I believe that the long-term consequences were negative, and that, as I said earlier in the program, we might have had the same outcome without keeping Hirohito on the throne. Keeping him on the throne made it very hard for the many Japanese people to say that they had their country had fought a war of aggression. After all, the man who led the war and who made it seem moral was never indicted, and if he had done no wrong, then they felt they had done no wrong. Now, I say this as an American keenly aware that we haven't come to terms with the Vietnam War, and no American leader has really been sanctioned for, those I mentioned, Johnson and Nixon, and those in their entourage have been sanctioned for their roles in keeping the Vietnam War going.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. To Champagne, another caller here, line 3. Hello?
That's a point that I, sort of was happy you highlighted right from the very beginning. It's sort of the karma that set in motion that, even though we had the trials of a great many of the military leaders that we let alone, and maybe the exception would have been made if Hitler hadn't committed suicide, but to this day, I still would like to see Henry Kissinger stand trial.
Yes.
We'll
have read Christopher Hitchens' book, which is worth noting here on the air. It's certainly.
And there certainly was a lot more than just Southeast Asia. I mean,
his
involvement
case.
In Latin America is pretty horrendous, too. You could indict him for that alone.
Yes. I quite agree with you. And there's a wonderful book by an author by the name of McAllister on called Dereliction of Duty, published by HarperCollins a few years ago, which looks at the Johnson administration and McNamara and others in Johnson's entourage. And the role of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's not only our civilian leaders who have been granted immunity. It's our military leaders as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, while we are pretty holier than thou about criticizing Japan and other countries for the way they obfuscate their own history. I think we have a lot to atone for in the way we teach history in our schools as well. Some places a little better than others, but still, I think that you know, we look at it in a pretty sugar-coated way. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to Chicago Line 4. Hello?
Speaking of roles people play, there was a person on General MacArthur's staff, happened to be a secretary, who was very instrumental in introducing the rights of women into the Constitution. And
B.T. Sirota?
I believe it is, yes. And so certainly it was acknowledged as being a wonderful person for doing that. And to this day,
he played an important role in the drafting of the model Constitution.
Yes, and I just thought I'd mention that, that someone deserves credit for doing that at least.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. You do, as we mentioned back in the when you were talking a little bit about the structure of the book and what you try to do with it, talk about Hirohito's upbringing and education and the forces that perhaps made him for a man who was conflicted, or one might say sort of had a sort of a dual nature.
Yes, I think it was I regarded it as very important to establish him as a human being, because this was a man who wanted to do good, who was educated to be benevolent, but there was that other side to his education which taught him that the most important question to ask and answer correctly was, is it in the national interest? Now, for Hirohito, the value that most motivated him was protection of his imperial throne, with himself occupying it. So remaining on the throne for the rest of his life and allowing the responsibility for the lost war and its atrocities to be obfuscated, you might say that this man really did legitimize falsehood. And in the long run, I argue that he damaged post-war Japanese democracy just as he'd earlier helped to destabilize party governments in the late 20s and early 30s.
One of the points that you make, or the things that you explain, is that it was the custom of the children of the royal family to be raised apart from their parents by a surrogate. And in fact, the person who was ended up doing this initially was a retired admiral. And if you look at Hirohito's education, many of the people that would have been his teachers and his mentors, many of them were military men. So he was steeped
in the military. A military man. And remember, every Japanese government from the mid-1880s down through 1945 was a mixed government of military and civilians, and the position of the military in the government was rather privileged. So Hirohito was always at the center of a circle of men much older than himself, many of them military men, I say early in the book, discussing his education, that the problem with him is, how do you understand the coexistence of these potentially conflicting identities that he assumes as his life unfolds through, you know, its many different phases? How does he manage to control his emotions? How does his education make him the person that he became, a man who thought of himself always as a giver of orders, as a descendant of an unbroken line of succession? You know, going back to hoary antiquity, I think he was a skeptical man by nature, a man of scientific bent, and he comes in early manhood to believe that he certainly is no deity. I mean, he doesn't, he knows that quite well, but at the same time, he decides it's quite all right if his people are taught that in the schools, And he makes compromises, and I present his education as the story of how he came to think of himself as a giver of orders and as a participant, along with others, in a policy-making process. You know, he doesn't think of himself as a dictator. He's not a dictator, just as he's not a man for whom war is absolutely central to his character. But he is a man, strong-willed at times, who believes that his views have to be interjected into the policy-making process. He can't be shut out of it. And, of course, in the 20s, when he becomes regent in late 21 for his sick father, the men who educate him impress this upon him, that his task is to retrieve the lost prerogatives of the throne. And so upon becoming emperor in his own right in the latter half of the 20s, he seeks to do this. And, of course, in the first 5 years of his reign, he's doing this on behalf of a foreign policy that is has been validated by his grandfather, Emperor Meiji, a policy of continued alignment with the two strongest Western powers, Britain and the United States. But then things change, and I describe in the central part of the book how he changes over the course of the 1930s and why.
I think that's a very important point, and one here maybe we can talk about for a couple of minutes, and I'm sorry to say that we're almost out of time, but it does certainly seem that here there's an important turning point when you look at the period of his regency and the early part of his reign, when there is this, one might say, revitalization of the institution of the emperor, and also at the same time an upsurge in nationalism, that all of this that precedes what we think of being of the high point of the high period of Japanese militarism from the 15 years between 1930 and 1945. One wonders, would there have been a possibility at that point of things going in a different direction?
Yes. Well, throughout the book, I do ask these if questions, these modal questions, in order to underline the seriousness of the choices confronting Japan's leaders and Hirohito. And I see many missed opportunities, and as a historian, I reflect on them. And that's a way of, presenting the drama of events as they unfold very rapidly in that period.
Well, there is so much here, but I'm really sorry to say that we've used the time. 50 minutes can seem like a lot, but if the subject matter is deep and rich enough, it's really not. So I would certainly suggest to people, if they're interested in reading more on this subject, they should look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. It's published by HarperCollins, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, by our guest Herbert Bix. And I want to say to you, Professor Bix, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David, for having me on your show. Bye.